Welcome back, guys, to the Edge and Flow podcast. I'm here with my co-host, TJ Schwartz.
This is the resurrection season.
TJ and I basically have not talked in the last month. This has been a gnarly summer. This is going to be a super messy episode. Maybe slightly more disorganized than most. But we're kind of like, I think, back on track now a little bit. TJ and I had started talking before we hit record, and I could just kind of feel the proverbial floodgates kind of opening, and we decided we should probably just start rolling. Dude, how are you doing?
I'm doing actually very well. And
Yes.
that's because I have a weekend of hanging out with the kids to look forward to, which haven't been around for a few weekends, so that's nice. And yeah, I'm just finally lowering the vibration a little bit. So
Slowly tapering off. Okay, well, where we were at a minute ago was you were talking about your plans, and you were saying, I thought something that was like pretty interesting, which was right now you're really focused on making like your plans achievable on a weekly basis. Is that, give me some like background into that.
I was just gonna say, it's really natural in like the modern economy to make everything monthly, because mortgages are monthly and rent is monthly. All the I mean, seems like everything's monthly, car payment or whatever. And it's like, to me, I lived on a monthly basis. Like it was like a 12-month rhythm with the business, with like trying to reach goals, make sure we've met our needs. And it was sometime back, I don't know, within the last 12 months, but I can't remember exactly when. It might have been late, like last fall. Started looking at everything as weekly instead of monthly, so that the first of the month is not really that ceremonious. It's really actually every Monday that is sort of when I gear up for the goals of the week. And just sort of having the basic arithmetic of like, if we do this every week, then the monthly goals are a byproduct. Like, I don't have to think about that. Reason being is it's like, rather than a monumental lift on the first of the month that gets you in gear, and then you have this, freak out session for 10 days working hard, and then like kind of a burnout fizzle, and then over again. It's like, if I can compress that, like, I don't know if stress is the right word, but that like drive into like a 48, like a Monday and Tuesday, like is where it's really cranking. And then Wednesday and Thursday is like you're starting to kind of put it together, but it's like you've already made most of the lift, at least mentally and like drive wise. Then it's like, then you have the weekend, and it's easier on my brain to have a cycle of like stress and relaxation on a weekly basis rather than on a monthly
Than a
basis.
monthly. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Oh, I mean, just from a overall success rate too, I think like the more consistent you can make like the small habits to be successful, like the lower the likelihood of the bigger goals falling short, right? If you like look at this like batch work with knives, I've kind of always thought that. Like, I know there's makers who are like, I'm working on this batch and it'll be done in 2 months. And it's like, however many knives. And that always, I think with like my ADHD, I just don't think that method works for me. But I also looked at it, I'm like, man, like if you can't finish that thing for some reason, it's like that's a huge amount of income revenue that might get delayed versus like maybe over the course of the month, like the overall output is slightly less, but it like is happening like very consistently. And I think that, I don't know, coming, dude, like coming out of this summer, I think that like really hits home. Just because like I look and I'm like, some of the projects and like the longer timelines have been drastically altered by like small things that have happened day to day, like with the kids or, you know, with just anything other than work. And like, I think that the part of this is like fairly relevant is like, we make plans based on like the best possible circumstances.
Yeah.
But it's very rarely ever that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I wonder if you had to like make like a generalized percentage to account for failure. Like someone's done this, like Toyota has done this. Someone's done this. Like what is that percentage?
Yeah. Right. Like a margin of error, I guess you might call it.
It's like margin of error for an 8 hour, like a, like say, like for you, right? You're a 10 hour workday. Okay. 4 days a week. Mm-hmm. You make a plan. You're like, okay, here's my production plan. What percentage of that actually becomes the productive work?
Ooh, that's tough for me because I've gotten into the position where I've struggled with this, and that is having help in the shop here. It's like the like more boots on the ground productivity is in their hands more than mine by quite a bit. And for me, it's harder to measure the productivity that I have because it's more ethereal, like bigger picture is what I'm usually like focused on.
Yeah.
And so I'm visiting like the shop needs in terms of over the next few weeks, like making sure I'm ordering the right stuff, making sure we have the right plan, making sure if we're going to launch a new model, is it going to be ready by this time? What needs done on that? And so I can't really measure it in like output.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I
you don't really need to, I guess, in that way, because you're thinking like overall shop output, not like personal output. Here's a question. Is your process dialed enough that you would be able to hire someone to like you're saying, like materials, components, like all of these small things, like is it dialed enough that you could have someone doing that?
Yeah, I think so. Having either someone who's working on the shop floor who also has the task of ordering and things and like materials management. Yeah, that could be done.
Materials manager. Yeah. Well, I was thinking like, what would that role be? And like how much of your time actually goes to that? I don't know.
Fortunately with the Kanban, that's not been very difficult. The Kanbans make it to where I don't feel like I need to delegate because it's only like a 30 minute thing every week.
Maybe it like eliminates, and by not delegating that, you like maintain ultimate control over it.
Yeah. And the thing is though, we brought on a new line, like with the LC5, and it's like every single piece is different. I think the only piece that's the same of hardware is like the eyelets in the sheath.
Talking about from your standard models,
from our other or models. Okay. So it's like the LT5 is not even Kanban yet, because the initial batches were too exploratory. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To where it's like, we got to order some bigger numbers to start on these bigger batches to get us rolling. But I was talking to the guys in the shop this week that it is now time to like establish the Kanbans for each of those things.
Right.
Which means calculating what is the correct volume of parts. And that is related to the lead time for those parts.
Right.
And so I still have to do that. So I'm in charge of, you know, establishing that order flow for that new line. And then with the idea that once you put in the groundwork on that, you could have another model that uses those same parts or similar enough that you're now stacking in a different way. The Kanban, once something is Kanban, it's basically a zero stress, no lift. Like I don't have to worry about it. I do order it myself, but it's not something I think about. But it's new exploratory stuff. It's like, how do you Kanban it? When do you Kanban it? It's the system design, which
the energy usage, I think, around system design. This last couple of months has been interesting for me because I think I've dealt with this in a way that I haven't really had to before, but it's like made it very clear. But like the energy usage around like system development is so high.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all problem solving. It's all new task. And I think on a custom side, So like for me, the perfect storm would be like example would be like show prep, where I'm not actually working from a system, but the I'm designing the show. And so the energy usage to come up with like the model variations, the finishes, the materials at a scale that is pretty like pretty high number wise for what I'm normally doing. It's probably cognitively one of the hardest tasks. I like struggle with it every time. And I keep trying to figure out a way to like, can that, but it's all, a lot of times it's like one-off things. And I don't actually know how to do it. From your standpoint. Yeah. It's like, right. You're, as soon as that system is designed, that cognitive load is done for the foreseeable future until you make another round of changes. So
you have a reason to do something different. Yeah.
Where I've been seeing the variation to this. So basically I did like pre-Blade Show, I was working on the Kihoku, right? And that was like the big deep dive, got it running, got like first production kind of like run 10 pieces, like sprint run. It works. Just this week I started running them again, and that is like illustrative of like my last month. But the peace of mind and like the shift from going from what I had been working on, was like all this one-off stuff for Pacific Northwest custom show, to going back to something where I'm like, I have a process, I'm starting this process, okay, the process is working. It was shocking. All of a sudden it was like, oh, I'm just working, not problem solving. I'm not like putting out fires. I'm not trying to figure out like next steps. I'm literally just acting.
Mm-hmm.
That's super interesting to me.
Yeah. And I think buy in to your own systems. And if you have employees, them buying into your systems.
Yeah.
That's like where the victory is, because it's like, if you can design a system, but you can't get bought into it, obviously it's not going to, I mean, that counteracts the benefit of it. But
trying to think of like a good, you know, the example that first came to mind is when we were talking about tool offsets and how to achieve that, basically reading about shops trying to shift to like a tool setter. And like old machinists just being like, no, I don't want to do that. Like I set off this block, you set off, like, I don't want to do a probe or whatever. So that would be a good example of like a good process that is hard to get people to actually utilize.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you can also sometimes say, I feel like that if you can't get buy-in on a system, it could mean the system is bad. You know what I mean? Like, it's not always, but you have to make determinations on that of like, it's just like, you know, economic models and stuff. It's like human nature has to be accounted for in systems. It's like, if it's only as good as what you're willing to actually do in real life. You know what I mean? So that's
this is like we're in, I think, like perfectionism and like some like neurodivergent traits are like really, really tricky. Right. Like if you're like on like the, you know, autism spectrum or something, where you're like, you have this like very, very defined sense of like right and wrong, and that translates to a method, and you're like, no, this process is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, but like the humans around you actually like can't do that.
Yeah.
I bet that comes up pretty frequently, actually, where you're like one process, or like I like with engineers, like process engineers, like looking at things and being like, this is the way we do it. And you're like, we can't do that.
Yeah.
Like the humans can't do like, or won't interact with it that way.
Yeah. And it also like there's a gut feeling also of like, to what degree is the system flexible? Because it'd be a flawed idea going in to say that like, this is the rule of law and that there's no scenario where there's flexibility. Because, you know, for example, like I'm trying to order for the LT5 to start it out, I created a spreadsheet with links for every single part with a calculator in it. So if I type in the batch size, it populates the number units for genius, every single part of the knife. So I just have to, like when I start a new batch, I type in the number at the top. I change all of the quantities to red. And then I go click on each link and order that quantity and change it to green. And if there's something that's like weird, I have to change it to yellow. If it's like, oh, there's going to be a lead time or I can only get 50% of these right now. So that I can come back and be like, okay, there's one yellow left. Like, and I can dig into that to make sure I'm on track. So that's like in place of what'll eventually be Kanban. But what I'm getting at is that, for example, some of the hardware that I have, there's this one particular hardware that I really like from a distributor that has a minimum for the dealer discount, but the minimum is a lot higher than what I needed for this batch. And so it's like, that's where the flexibility in the system comes in. It's like, okay, so this sheet is telling me I need to order this many, but I'm not allowed to order that many. So I have to order more. And it's like, that's an aberration. That's like
right.
The system has to flex because that now means I have to like type off to the side, like carry over this many for the next batch, you know what I mean? Or whatever. So that's where it's having rules and systems and then a record of when and why you break them too. You know what I mean? So it's like,
that's crazy because that's a you job. So that as a trickle down with an employee, I always thought this was like interesting conceptually, which is like, where do you give like autonomy and the ability to make changes? Like I can't remember what the exact context was, but I remember talking with someone and basically the idea was that their employees like didn't have to come to them. I mean, this was like around a pricing thing or something. It's like, okay, if it's under $200, like you don't have to ask. And they were like, that cut down on the amount of questions that were being fielded by like 80% or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, that right there, like that's an efficient. So if you're like, okay, when it's like a, if this, then that scenario, you're allowed to order 100, you need to order 500 to actually be able to order them, but it's under the total cap of like your monetary limit.
Yeah.
So you just order the 500. It's like, that stops a question from coming to you.
Yeah.
Yep. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think, you're right. And making sure anybody other than you that's involved in the system, that they have parameters, but not like such tight guidelines that they constantly feel like they're having to check with you. Because that if they have to, you know, if you're overseeing the system in that like granularity, then that's not the goal of the system either.
Right.
For sure.
I'm trying to figure it out right now. Like we're after this thought, can we do our shop updates? Cause like this is where it's getting messy. Thinking about like an employee and like even running right now through the Kihoku, I'm like, I could have someone in, but I couldn't set somebody loose because I'm still developing the process. And it almost feels like it would make it more difficult because I think my brain would be itchy being like, all right, like I made these changes, like just let me run it and like make sure it's working. And like, okay, like you stand over here. Like I would like run it and like, now I got to make some more changes. It's like just not there yet. I could bring someone in for like parts of the process, but not like I couldn't give any ownership yet.
Yeah.
And nobody else could make the changes that I need right now without being like a very high level employee.
Yeah. I think back to the one man shop days for me and how I was trying to settle on a process, not necessarily like as fast as possible, but I tried to each layer of the process. I was like, okay, I need to settle on best practice and move on sooner rather than later. So that when I hand this like, you know, theoretical sort of manual to the next person, like all the pages aren't just like scratched out and like notes and stuff. Like it needs to be concise.
Yeah.
And even though I'm the one doing it and it doesn't necessarily need to be concise for me, it's like the process eventually needs to become concise, even if I think it's not quite optimal, but I'll revisit it and make it more optimal, but it needs to be concise, even if not optimal.
You know, I think that I sent you that message yesterday. I was like, this is running like 100%. Mm-hmm. Now it's like optimization.
Yeah.
I think almost like compartmentalizing some of that process, like, or stages, just compartmentalizing stages. You're like, right. Like I'm looking at Kihoku and I'm like, you are, I think it's technically still in a prototyping phase.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Cause my setup, like I have some permanent fixturing, but I might have to improve it. I have some like of the actual physical product, I think is dialed, but maybe that part's not fully fixed or something where it's like, mm-hmm. I could say it's like, and I'm producing it. Like I can make numbers, but it doesn't feel like it's something that I could build like a worksheet for and just be.
It just has too many holes right now.
Too many holes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good way to put it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, but there has to be a point where, and this is like something that I have always struggled with. It's like, where do I actually stop?
Mm-hmm.
And then where does it become a completely different product? I remember like doing like this is probably 18 years ago or something. I would make a model. I'd make a pattern. I would make a run. I would make a change to the pattern. And I remember one model specifically at one point looking at it and being like, this is not the same model.
Mm-hmm.
I've made these micro changes until 100% that should have been a model and this should be a model.
Mm-hmm.
That is really easy to do when you're doing hand like drawn templates or like hand shaped templates. On CNC with fixturing, that starts to become like a real problem.
Yeah.
So it's like, you have to get it to a point and then be like, okay, this is the product. If you don't like it, you cancel it or you make a new generation of it, but it's not like little changes constantly.
Yeah. It has to be some discrete finality to it. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Okay. Shop updates. What do you got going on?
I'm amazed and really happy I didn't step foot in the shop or in my own house for six straight weekends, just with weddings in the family, bachelor party, blade show, fifth anniversary. I mean, just like a stack.
Everything. Yeah.
Cascade. And it was a fantastic time. And I'll be honest, like there was anxiety about like, man, what's happening to the business that like with my mental load totally being diverted, like, what's going to be at the end of this? You know what I mean? And big testament to Dalton, huge props, and Steven in the shop. It went really well. So from a business standpoint, even though I was extremely distracted, and not available, gone a couple weeks out of the last month, and we came out like out of this month. I mean, we're in a better position than we've ever been. I would say by quite a bit. And I think it's partly because we're grabbing new gears in this new shop and finally, and we're seeing it materialize with the new efficiency levels. And that continued to occur even when I was sort of making a disappearing act here and there. So I'm really proud of the team. And I mean, I'm happy with what's going on.
That's amazing.
LT5 is being converted into a more weekly model like I talked about, so that's kind of the next thing, but it's off to the races and we're trying to
build. So previous to this, was Blade Show the LT5 like kind of like debut, or it had it already dropped?
I'd sold a few before that.
Okay.
Yeah, it was probably a couple weeks before that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, man, good team, good product. Like the process is the product. So you guys are doing well. It's interesting, like summer is really tricky, man. Like with kids and small teams. I had sent you a message a while back because I saw that our friends at Mark of the Maker, somebody had commented like they had also been like kind of like missing some episodes, and everyone's like, it's summer, like we're our kid like things are busy with kids, things are busy with like families traveling. I have been in a similar boat to you, kind of, but like, I actually don't know. So shop update for me, we got to do blade update too. Basically post blade for me, I came home, I was psyched. I was on the plane. I was like, I felt so good. The show was really successful. I felt like recharged, which is like not all together common for me after trade shows. I didn't feel like tired, run down, anything. I came home. Next day, I tested positive for COVID. That wrecked me for a week. And honestly, it may have been like kind of a blessing in disguise because I just slept. And I'd been burning so hot before blade. I think my body would have, it needed something anyway. Directly during that, we had family come into town for like 8 days. So like family vacation starts. I miss half of that, roll from that into family vacation, out of that into show prep. And that's like where I've been existing since then, like mid June. The show is next weekend. It's been insane. And this is like, you know, it's tied in with like kids and summer camps and like trying to be like an active father and like trying to let my wife remember who I am. And like, yeah, it's a lot. Summer's a lot.
Yep.
Two shows back to back in the summer, probably not an ideal plan for me.
Yeah. I can hear that. And also, yeah, the beginning of summer, because it feels like everyone's pent up for that warm weather. And then that's when everything gets planned. And then by like August, it's like, we're all just like cooking in the heat and just sort of waiting for fall. You know,
seriously.
Yeah.
Dude, I've spent so long working for myself, and like this will have to change at some point because of the boys, but I literally, holidays do not enter my thought process. I don't think about it. We've talked about this before. Like, I was homeschooled and like, I work for myself. Like, I do not think I don't even think in terms of like summer break, because I didn't get one. So at this point, like, there's so many things where I'm like, I kind of get blindsided. And I think like where we're at right now, which is not flexible time-wise, it's like one, like, oh, it's the 4th of July. Like, I actually, in my brain, I'm like, I'm not set up to like take the day off with my family. So I'm like doing these, like, I'll get up, work super early, work a half day, try to like cut and like go hang out. It is not a maintainable way of working. I don't want to maintain it, but like, I look at it and I'm like, this would not be something that I could keep up with for a whole lot longer.
Yeah.
It's a trip.
Yeah. It's I can relate. Having been married, like, it's starting to change me a little bit, but like you were saying, the holidays, other than, you know, Christmas or whatever, it's like, it's just, you look and you're like, oh, tomorrow. Yeah, even my birthday, it's like, oh shoot, tomorrow's my birthday. Yeah.
Like, yeah. I just don't think about it. Man. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. So basically, like, right now, shop update for me, like, it's just been in like full custom production mode for months. Feels certain way, it feels pretty good. Like, I'm very happy with my output, but I'm ready. Like, again, starting the Kihoku, I think like it feels really, really good. So the plan is basically like get back from Seaside and dive really hard into the Kihoku and just try to get on like a monthly routine that is like a manageable workflow and like production output. During this time, I've also like had some like work backups. Like, I've got design work for Boker, design work for CRKT that like I need to get in, and just have not had like the time or the bandwidth to even like sit with it.
Yeah.
A lot's a lot. Like,
yep. I hear it, dude. I hear it. Yeah, that we try to keep the schedule for the month of July pretty wide open. It's not going to stay that way, but yeah, trying to the weekends, I mean, just, give ourselves some breathing room here for a little bit.
You're doing
But
it well, man. This is definitely not by design. And I would say like four, 6 months ago, beginning of the year, I was on like a very good work kind of like life cycle. This is just like, it was just a sleeper kind of like ramping up in like, this is how I used to work pre-kids. Does not work with current lifestyle.
So how does it, how do, like, what's the excitement level for the work? How do you feel about that?
Right
Like, is it,
now, honestly, I've actually been pretty excited, and I think like it doesn't feel like drudgery.
I was gonna say, so like the like long hours and stuff, it's sort of a reinvigoration in some ways. You know what I mean? That's the silver lining.
Yeah, there's and I think I've got enough projects that are interesting to me that I think that's been very helpful. And all of these things are refinements. Where like, okay, I know that if I'm gonna work 7 days a week, like I need some like dopamine hits. So it's like I ordered a bamboo printer. Like some of this stuff, like coping mechanisms are real. I didn't open the bamboo printer because I also know that if I open the box, I'm
Pandora's
gonna
box.
lose 3 days.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to see the new shiny and I'm going to go set it up and then I'm going to try to make something that's not going to work. Then I'm going to get involved in problem solving and I'm not going to be able to detach. But the box sitting on the shop floor is enough of like a driver where I'm like, oh, that's sick. When I get home, I'm going to mess with that thing. It's here. It's really weird. I've always had this thing around like, in the last stages of show prep, a lot of times I will crave junk food. It's really, really weird. But I allow
Comfort
myself,
food.
yeah, it's full comfort food and it's like
Yeah.
trash. It is like, I want McDonald's and I like have like a specific thing that I've gotten for years and years and years. And I can tell, like, oh, I'm at that stage of show prep because my body is like, it's needing like this last little push. I think the other part that's really helped is like pre-Blade, like all of my daily habits kind of fell away. Like I literally did not have the time. Since I've been back, like I've been able to make time to like go surfing and do like certain activities with the kids and like just have like 10% more flexibility than I did. And that I think has really, really helped. So, I mean, not ideal, but I don't know. Like some of this stuff, like I think it's okay to push really hard sometimes, even if just to like for the muscle memory of like letting myself know that I can do it and then be like, no,
And
I don't want to do that.
well, it's the same thing of like, yeah, reminding you of what the goal is. You know what I
What the
mean?
goal
'Cause
is. Yeah.
it's like, I don't want to have to work this hard, but I'm going to work this hard to remind myself why I don't want to work this hard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And
Like,
to be fair too, like this is, I mean, the bright side of this is like financially, like it's great. Like I'm gonna do two shows within 2 months of each other, and that's a big cash influx. Because I'm making more than I would in a normal month. It's coming at a time cost, but like when we come out at the end of it, it'll be good financially. And so like I think that has to be taken into account too. And it also drives like the like hyper focus, like creativity. Like I've come out with like figured out a couple new processes and like in this time, like we've actually like worked through like a few new products and it's all of those things are really, really good. I think I was telling you earlier, my biggest fear right now is that I've been on this cycle now for, I think it's over 3 months. So like over 3 months of basically 7 days a week. When I'm done with Seaside, I don't know what my taper off is going to be because I don't think my body is going to be okay with like taking a break. So I'm trying to figure out like what the wind down is, and then making sure that that wind down doesn't turn into like just like exhaustion, like burnout, like
check out
like, oh man, like the fight's over, like I'm gonna not do anything.
I saw a funny thing, and it was like the caption was how my brain works, and it was like, I really want to relax, but I wish I could find a way to make relaxing more productive.
100%
Yeah, which you have to be careful about that. Like, I mean, you can make relaxation unrelaxing by overlaying productivity on it too. So
it's super easy.
Yeah. So sometimes like a Netflix show is fine.
Anything. Or whatever. So I've noticed two things. So for me, like truly doing nothing is, that's the only point where like I can get my brain to stop. So like reading is actually the best. That is the best technique. If I'm like, I need to like let my brain slow down and recharge. Like even like playing video games doesn't work the same way, because you're problem solving and you're like getting these little like spikes of adrenaline or dopamine or whatever it is as you're playing. Reading is like such a flat kind of baseline.
A little bit of meditation aspect to it.
Yeah. It's like almost sleep in a weird way.
Yeah.
That's like very, very helpful.
Yeah.
Dude. I don't know.
Reading. I need to do more reading. I haven't done much.
I do five pages. I do. It's not much, but I do 5 pages a day, like without fit, like just as, and it's, I make it through books. You know, at five pages a day, because a lot of times what will happen is like you'll read the five and then you'll be like, oh, I'm gonna like keep reading, and maybe I'll read 10
in the middle
pages.
Of a
right, sometimes getting five, like my brain is so scattered that getting five is actually a struggle. Or I'm rereading a page a couple times. I can always tell that's when I'm not like connected. Weird like tie-in, but have you seen any of the Inside Out movies with the kids?
I think I've like caught pieces of them, but I haven't actually sat down
and
watched.
We actually, that was like a fun break. We like went and took the kids to see Inside Out 2. It's really funny because there's like a new, like for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's like a movie. It's like basically emotions as characters, like inside of a body.
Yeah.
But there's like a new emotion introduced, and the emotion is anxiety. And it's like hyper productive. And I was watching it and I was like, oh man, like that's too on the nose of like how it's like planning for every contingency and but you don't have a solution for this problem that's going to be directly related to this situation that you are creating now. And I was like, that's probably something to look at a little bit.
Yeah, I need to watch that. That's it.
It's really good.
I love the premise. I mean, the idea of like, basically anthropomorphizing emotions, you know what
it's
I mean,
pretty like, great, like if you think about it for kids, I mean, or me apparently, like being able to put a name and a face to something that is very clearly felt, that's like pretty clever.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I'll have to watch that. I'm sure the kids would dig it.
There you go, movie night.
Yeah. So we brushed by Blade. You want to talk more about Blade?
Yeah, I was just gonna say, let's do Blade update.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Blade.
Your first exhibited main Blade Atlanta show, right?
I have appeared in other exhibits, but I have not had my own, like with my banner, my table, my booth.
That's what I mean.
It's the first time. Yeah.
Okay.
And so. It was a great experience. It was the longest time I've ever spent in Atlanta, because I've never had to have the front and back end days for like tear down and
what setup. Were you there?
Had it been Wednesday through Monday.
Yeah, that's what we usually do. It's real.
Yeah, it's a good long haul. But I really enjoyed being at Blade Show, which I expected I would. I think it was worthwhile. I really enjoyed the conversations with customers. I think that's really the whole reason to do it for me. The lead in and coming out of it was like not as good feeling, because it was a because this the month after it, I knew it was going to be an absolute train wreck with my availability. And right. then before it, we you know, move shops and we're trying to build that head of steam and the momentum, especially with like a new model. And it felt like where the show was in the just in time was like right when we get momentum is like a giant curb to just trip on. You know what I mean? And so it like at the show was great, but you and I talked about like the timing of it was very off. Like it was very off for me. Just maybe that's mostly in my head, but it was very disturbing.
Well,
to
it broke your flow.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is okay. I mean, shows do that, but it was just at a time when the flow was like picking up steam and it was like overdue. Like it really, it was time for us to get going in the new shop. And we had been doing well, but it was like, we were putting all the pieces together and then it just fell apart again. But luckily that's where I had that feeling of like this after the fact, I'm going to be super unavailable and this is going to, could be messy. And we were able to pull through it. So it's like maybe the consequences weren't what I thought.
Sure.
But it was the show was amazing. A lot of good conversations, a lot of good people.
Any high points of the show for you?
High points, same as, I mean, we talked about it last year with high points. I really enjoy talking to international people. I don't know what it is, but I'm like really drawn to talking to people from who came in from other countries to be there because it just kind of expands my world. You know what I mean? So obviously Blade Show's full of international folks and,
it's also like a high level of like interest and passion, which is, I think, really fun. Like if someone's flying in from Europe or Asia, like that, they're really in it. Those are fun conversations.
Yeah. And good time talking to you, although we talked for all of 20 to 30 minutes for a whole 6 days.
I know. I think our like, and it was a high point actually, was like the first night we were there.
Yeah.
Sitting down in the bar, hanging out with Tim and Ann Reeve.
Yep.
And just having like a long conversation. It's what we're doing right now. It's like ranges from life to like business to like, you know, being able to sit with someone like Ann too, or there's so many years of experience and like industry knowledge. It's like that to me, that's shows. Like that is so valuable. You can't recreate it. Like, and it's so organic. That was fun.
Yeah, no,
that was the time that you and I talked to. That was it.
Like, Well, we talked and then the group got bigger and we didn't, which is fine. But we, I guess that's why we have a podcast, huh?
I mean, but, it's not wrong.
Yeah. But no, it was a good experience. The only thing is we did get into the big room with our booth.
Yep.
They rearranged the big room a little bit. Our booth space, I can't complain at all because it's our first year.
Yeah.
No problem with it, but I could see in that booth space why location matters, because we had the beginner booth space for the big room. You know what I mean? Right. So it was like a little bit less traffic, probably a lot less traffic where we were at, which is fine. You know what I mean? Like it's how it goes. But
yeah. Well, and it gives you the ability to look and be like, all right, like this is something I always talk about, which is like, the trade show provides the venue. It's a venue.
Mm-hmm.
It's on us to also improve like our demand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And what are you doing to let people know where you are? What are you doing to build hype for the show? What are you doing? And it's like, if you're counting on foot traffic, placement makes a lot of a difference. Like, you know, door right. It's like the old school dudes, like they still talk about like where they want to be like in the room. Mm-hmm. But it's, I think for a lot of them, there's no like pre-build.
Yeah.
Right. Different culture.
And that goes for me too. I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about it in that way. I was mostly concerned with getting there, getting product there, which is possibly kind of a missed opportunity.
I mean, not really. It's an impossibility. Not an impossibility, but like, it's a lot to undertake, especially without having it be like, oh, like next year, if you go into this next year and you're in the same spot, you will know that you have to do something to like drive some people to your booth.
Yeah.
But you didn't know that going into it this year.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's not obvious. Like it's a new booth, a new space. You don't even really think about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's a fact.
Overall successful.
Overall successful. Yes. It did also confirm the Blade Show is EDC heavy, I think.
Yes.
The or Overland Sport model is our EDC model. From there yes. up, you get further and further away from EDC.
Yeah.
It was obvious in that room who was there. Obviously, yeah. the Overland Sport, our number one seller at the show by far. And I think that correlates to the fact that I'm coming from the Blade Show world. I'm coming from the EDC world. I'm known for designing folders. The sport fits my history with yeah. being an EDC person.
Yeah.
And so the bigger knives, I noticed like it wasn't the right room. You know what I mean? And it became, I talked to some other people, not that like there aren't some people like that, but you think about the thousands of people that go in there. It's not super dense with someone that's going to buy a 5-inch camp knife like the LT5.
Right.
And I talked to some other makers who said the same thing. They're like a bushcraft guy. He's like, yep, when I come to Blade Show, I make my smallest models.
Right.
And it just, you know what I mean? So that was really informative and interesting, which I'm happy about because I'm happy with having the Overland Sport as an outdoor aesthetic that is an EDC knife.
Yeah.
And so it still ties in because its big brother is the true outdoor knife.
Yeah.
And then we are now paving the way, like with the LT5, to enter the sphere that I'm not necessarily known in. So it's like sort of building new inroads into like true, you know, bushcraft outdoorsman worlds. And then maybe possibly eventually hunting and stuff like that. And I like that I can see distinct pools that we're targeting
mm-hmm.
because we could try to double and triple dip in a given demographic or given group.
I love that. I love that so much.
So I'm trying to make sure they all are correlated to each other, but they serve different crowds or needs. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, I don't even know if like correlated. They just like, this is like an authenticity issue, right? Like not a cash grab.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're like, oh, this thing's popular. Let me do this thing. You're like basically looking at a product line and being like, okay, yeah, like I have roots here. My interest currently is here. There's an overlap and a value, right? All of that like works together. I while you were talking, I had two thoughts. First thought is, and maybe this is like an, as I say it, going to be an obvious statement. So like, is EDC the new tactical? I think yes is the answer.
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. And when I say that, what I mean is early, like for a long time, like 2000s, I would maybe 90s on into the mid 2000s, tactical was kind of the catch-all term for like the modern folders that really became popular.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not a hunting knife, it's not a slip joint. It's not a Bowie, right?
It's really like the absence of wood and like high polish.
Yeah, for the most part, right?
Defaulted it to being called a tactical. Yeah,
right. And then that starts to like get blown out or like changed, and then you have like gentleman's tacticals. I use the term post tactical. I would almost say that in certain ways, like now, like post tactical could almost just be rolled into EDC. Like mm-hmm. probably could, right? Mm-hmm. From a design standpoint. So that to me, and why was tactical so popular? I would say, I think a lot of it was around utility mm-hmm. and form factor, and the fact that like, okay, so at that point, like, you had big, like combat knives, like big, that's like tactical, but no one's carrying like a huge fighting knife mm-hmm. for the most part. They will carry a pocket knife that feels the same way yeah, aesthetically, has the same, yeah. yeah, the DNA, the design language, like that's there. And you're like, this is sick. I can put it in my pocket. Okay. I think it's basically the same process. And we've talked about this a little bit, but I think that with tactical custom, at a point, the product got so hard to get, people started to branch out into these like smalls, like EDC, pry bars, things like the SciPop, Nux, like drivers, like all of these little things. And at first people bought them because they were kind of cool and they were available. And then they liked it, so they bought more and the collections grew. Mm-hmm. So my thought is like, people probably bought tacticals. I would imagine there was a lot of makers that got into tacticals because they were doing higher end pieces, saw tactical folders as like something they could produce that was like maybe not as over the top, engraved, Damascus, whatever it was. But then the availability of that thing initially drove demand, created collectors that made the market larger. I think the same process has happened with EDC.
Yeah. And I think there still is a bastion of the tactical of what you're describing though, too.
Absolutely.
I think the EDC era that we're in, I think it's an expansion more than a conversion.
Oh yeah. I think they're all expansions because
yeah,
through these changes, there's always makers that are doing the thing that they were doing before. And they're at a point where they're selling everything that they can make. And like they're situated where they want to be with the product that they want to sell.
Yeah. Yeah. I think. Yeah. And one thing that's interesting to kind of look across the spectrum is when I look at like the bushcraft, the other direction.
Yeah.
I call it the other direction because that's how I have the visual model, but it's like different categories favor different things. And I've noticed bushcraft doesn't favor innovation nearly as much as other sections. And it favors like value and performance over innovation. Whereas EDC favors uniqueness and like, I guess, head turningness more so.
Right.
And so that's where I'm trying to straddle of like, what are the customers wanting in these different pools without.
Well, and like collector versus true user, like there's user collectors, there's collectors, and there's users, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, bushcraft is a great example of that, especially around like a value priced product
mm-hmm.
where you're going to go out and you're going to beat this thing up. It's just knives are consumables at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Most people don't think of it that way, but like to sharpen a knife, you're removing material. You sharpen enough times, you lose the tool.
Yeah.
Right. It's going to wear down to nothing. It's going to take a long, long time, but doesn't make it not a consumable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that group looks at knives in that way. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to use this thing till it's used up and then I'll replace it. But they're not like necessarily worried about like replacing it with higher quality or higher price point or, upgrading.
Yep.
They need it to do that job or that job better. If there's a reason they can do the job better at a good value, I think it's attractive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I found that to be an interesting study with, like I said, the LT5 project, because a lot of people who would buy 5-inch camp knives, I think, have never heard of us. You know what I mean? Because I designed titanium frame locks for a long time. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, it's exciting. But I guess to digress with the blade show is like, it confirmed my suspicion that it's like, this is an EDC with some tactical sort of crowd. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I'm happy to be in that pool and I really enjoyed it, but it changes the way I look at it for the future of like, we are going to have to curate for that show.
I think I want to make a modification to that. I think you have to curate for shows.
Mm-hmm.
If you are doing a show correctly, you are curating for that show.
Yeah. 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 That's clear to me now. I think it was less clear to me before. I think I went into it of like, I want some of everything.
Right.
And then I go there and I'm like, well, I do have some of everything, which is good.
Yeah.
But I should have known what they were going to want. And that is,
I think that's really tricky. I think where I would look is like, you want some of everything and then something specific.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's about getting the perfect mix of products for an audience, because that changes.
Mm-hmm.
But so here would be like a way that I would look at this. Like, you have the LT5 and you're like, this is not an LT5 crowd. If next year you showed up, and you have the LT5, and you post about the LT5, but you bring five LT10s. You will find real quick that the knife audience that's not an LT5, there's going to be a bunch of people that show up to the table to buy a 10-inch version of that knife. Because that 10-inch version is the specific thing that is rare, that is interesting. And I think that I don't think it's a product problem. I think sometimes it's just like a visibility presentation, like availability issue.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Somebody in that room, we talk about this in the industry general, which is every time somebody tells you a product won't work, right? Specifically, let's just say fixed blades, right? So like if a production company is like, yeah, fixed blades don't sell. There is a company that all they are doing is producing fixed blades.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And making a lot of money doing it. That thought process holds across the entire industry, I think. For everyone who's like, oh, this type doesn't sell, there's somebody doing it.
Exactly.
What are they doing differently?
Yeah, there is some benefit in focus, I think, because like fixed blades at the end of the day are their own niche that obviously is subdivided into niche. But it's like, I think there is once you become known for something,
yep,
that has power, because it's absolutely. Like if you want to get one of the best folders, there's names associated with the best folders.
Yeah.
And then there's names associated with the best fixed blades.
Right.
And there's enough of a chasm there that it's like, it's kind of like, you know, in the auto industry, which I always bring up, it's like, just because they make the best truck doesn't mean they make the best sports car. You know what I mean? Right. Like you might have totally different tastes. You're not like, the brand loyalty evaporates as soon as you change application.
Right. You know what I mean? Specific product. I'm going to make a fork. Is it a fork? Making a forecast? I'm going to forecast something. So first 7 years for me, like, was fixed blades. Okay. When I switched to folders, I think I lost 50% of my customer base. I didn't notice it because the folder market was so huge. I have a sneaking suspicion that you are in a similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I think that TJ Schwartz, the designer, built a huge customer base, like, and you said it, around like your modern, like technical, tactical folders.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Even if you don't consider them tactical.
Yeah.
But when you started producing your own product, you went fixed blades. And because of how you were doing it, you have like a huge uptick in customers. I actually bet a lot of those original customers that know you for the folders aren't in the mix.
Oh, that's 100% true.
If you were to debut a folder. Yeah. So, right. So it's like, if you at some point debut a folder, those people come back into the fold, which is what I'm experiencing now with fixed blades.
Going back to fixed blades.
And it's crazy to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sports car versus truck, I think, analogy, like summed up, is like, they're not gone. Some of them are, right? Like there's attrition, but like, it's just right now, it's like the product isn't their product.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think that's super interesting.
That's 100% a fact. Cause I have people regularly who tell me, they're like, I just put two and two together that you're the same Schwartz, because it's like, it's such a different sort of image that's around the fixed blades. People tell me that they knew of both of my identities without putting two and two together. Yeah.
I think it's really fun. It's been satisfying getting back into fixed blades a little bit, because like there's this side of the market that just absolutely loves them. Whether it's user or collector, there's a side that is what they like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really fun being able to kind of like reconnect to that. And I love fixed blades. Like I'm always a fixed blade guy.
Yeah. I feel authentic in selling fixed blades, because as soon as I started making my own,
yeah,
I, in my head, I'm like, I'm going to go straight to folders. That's all I know. But I started carrying it because I made it.
Right.
And then I started just not wanting a folder anymore. Like it actually captured me from a, not from a, like, this is what I made and I'm carrying it, but from a, like, I actually prefer fixed blades, I think,
yeah.
because I am fortunate enough to be in an environment where I can put an LT5 on my hip and
Yeah.
wear it 7 days a week. And there, I don't have any issue with that. You
Yeah.
know what I mean?
Nobody cares if you wear a sword.
Yeah. Right.
It's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to leave Blade Show yet. So there's two more things that tie in. Okay. So did you get a chance to walk the show?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not till a little later, but yeah.
Okay. But you got to do it. I noticed one thing overarching, and I just made like this weird tie-in. So the thing that I noticed is a huge uptick in micro production brands. Okay. So these are like white label slash like, oh, what we would consider like a white label or like OEM. So yeah. A designer is having a product made by an OEM company, generally in Asia. And then that in like building it like a brand around that.
Mm-hmm.
The tie-in that I just made is from tactical to EDC, the availability will, like, because of the availability of these like white label OEMs, are they like on track to become the next like most demand collected thing? Does it hold?
Well,
you see what I'm saying? It's like, because of availability, it is now the easiest product to actually get.
Mm-hmm.
So will people start to like be like, oh, this is a great design. The build quality is amazing. I can afford it. Right. And there's not a crazy line to get it.
Yeah.
I now have five of these things. I am now a collector of this thing and this genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think?
That's a good question. That's a really, because I mean, I've absolutely witnessed the exact same trend. It's a 6 or 8 year trend. But
sure.
It's really like heating up.
I think there was another thing that happened, which for some reason, Booth design. Well, I don't think it's weird actually. Because of the last 6 or 8 years, because of people increasing what they're doing, more and more people coming into a sphere, the booth and table game has been getting kind of better and better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this year I noticed it was like a lot of 6 foot tables had banners.
Yeah.
I think that I visually noticed, oh, I don't notice that name, or I don't know that name, and walk over and look at it and like, oh, okay, cool. It's like white label.
So I think we're seeing like a broad trend. We're seeing it materialize in the knife industry. I don't think it's a knife industry thing. I think what it is I follow some comedians and stuff. I was listening to where they were talking about how not long ago, if you're coming in as a comedian, you're trying to get on a sitcom, on a TV show, you're trying to get on Saturday Night Live, you're trying to get on the A-list, like primetime television,
right,
or in a movie. And you basically have to get into the big system and the big players to get ahead.
Okay.
And there's a new era in that scene where, because of like TikTok and Instagram, people are going straight to being famous,
right,
independently.
Right.
And I think that's what we're seeing in the knife industry, is like, it used to be you couldn't hire an OEM and have, you know, thousands of knives show up at your door.
Right.
Because without the infrastructure of like distribution, it just was like not going to work out.
This is good.
Whereas now you can go more direct to the customer, and you can become popular without infrastructure is really the difference. And that, I think, is in almost every single industry. You're seeing musicians get famous on platforms.
Dude, that's an amazing observation. I had not put that together in that way. And that feels 100% correct.
Like, you know, the guy like Richmond, North of Richmond.
Yeah.
That guy.
Great example.
It's like, he didn't get a record label. He didn't.
Right.
He just became famous for music. Right.
Yeah. You're basically... You're bypassing the system.
Yeah, it's a new bypass that opened up all the way through the economy, and I think it's being taken advantage of like all over the place.
Oh, that's super interesting. Okay, so then here would be like my add-on question. Is there is there a risk of longevity based in that because of a lack of a certain type of infrastructure going into it?
I think, exactly.
Would you say?
Yeah, because I'm not discrediting the value of infrastructure either, because the systematic approach that like a big business takes to like sustainability is probably lacking in a lot of these like business models. I'm not knocking anybody. Like, I wish everybody the best. I'm just saying
100%.
You have to be careful about walking into a new era where there's this new channel, but that doesn't mean everything that was done the old way is wrong either. You know what I mean? So,
what lessons can you take? Like, so here would be a just general commentary. Like, if you are doing this and you're doing like white label and you're doing social media, figure out where you can diversify.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that diversification is going to be the answer 9 times out of 10. Like, if I'm consulting with somebody, right? Like, where are you single line? Like, where are you diversified? Like, where can you support this system?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And you look at like some of the big brands, like if you're looking at the knife industry specifically, like a big box store,
right?
Or like an Amazon top rated item, like that, we all know, like that's a little bit of a rented land aspect to that. Like,
right.
You have to keep the knife in that glass case in the box store, and you're like, part of your company ethos is fighting for that position. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which is still the case, because if you're in this new channel where you're on like Instagram and TikTok or whatever it is, it's a different type of rented land that you have to be weary of, where it's like the rug, you're still standing on a rug that you don't own.
Right.
And so it's like, I don't know of a way. I mean, that's ultimately like the holy grail is like not standing on one of those rugs, but I don't know that that exists. So it's just being aware that like Instagram and YouTube and stuff, if these are your channels for like quote unquote getting famous outside of the system, it's like, do you know where the risk lies? You know what I mean?
Right. Because,
like an established business with like selling to big box stores or something, I mean, there's a relationship there. There's a human aspect to it. And there's like a battleground behind the scenes too, but they know that they've been doing it for 30 years or whatever.
Yeah. Same thing though. I mean, this is diversification, right? Because like you're a big box store and the buyer changes.
Yeah, exactly.
And that shifts the entire, process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then like I guess the other question with that would be like, okay, it's the availability. So it's like the infrastructure and the availability. It seems like it would be easier to overproduce at a time where that could hurt you than some of the other like more traditional methods,
mm-hmm.
right? Because like you can, in a way, you can turn on the tap and like, oh, order more. Maybe that happens at a time when everyone else orders more and that now is an issue.
Yeah.
Right. Versus like slower or like, I don't know, like more traditional manufacturing methods. Well, and it's weird because it's not even, I'm not saying traditional manufacturing methods, because like this is also industry specific. I'm talking about like, you know, if you are a custom knife maker or if you are a small knife manufacturer, like there are also some different types of limits. Right. Okay. So that was my big takeaway, like from Blade this year, was I just felt like, oh, the last one was this year felt like 100% pre-pandemic levels of excitement, and just like, it was busy.
Mm-hmm.
The line for the show, we talked about this a little bit, but the line for the show started Monday night before. So basically people that waited to get into the show, the people in front waited 5 days sleeping out front of a hotel.
Wow.
5 days.
I don't think I've seen them wait that long. And
I haven't. I'm sure it's happened. I remember like Wednesday, because I'd show up Wednesday, I'd go check the show, and like there'd be a few stragglers out there. This year, the majority of the people at the very front of the line were for Dark Timber Forge. So big shout out. I think he is doing something that is really representative of like how you build that. Like, why, how do people come and sit outside for 5 days? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's building a huge community. I think he does like campouts and like motorcycle runs. Nice. And like he's building community. So like the people that are hanging out in line is, you know, you've got guys from all over, they're just hanging out and eating food. And it's just another place that they're being community and visiting. Yeah. So props to like them and that side of the community, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. No, it was a vibrant Blade show for sure. It was, the sands were shifting in the room.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of sand in the room, you know,
a lot of sand in the room, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had a great show. We did it weird this year because we only did one day. We took Tom's booth for Saturday, and I really enjoyed it from a stress level. Like, I didn't have to bring as much product, but in reality, like, I probably brought 2/3 of what I would have done if I had done the whole weekend. And I think the big takeaway for me was that if I'm going to do Blade, I just need my own booth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's purely like this ownership thing where it's like, if I'm already doing all the work to like be there for a day, I might as well be there for three.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I might as well really dig in and just be like, all right, I'm doing my Saturday events, my Friday events, like, and I'm going to get more time with people.
Yeah. So, the cost of getting there along with the human costs, you might as well amortize that over a bigger.
That's my thought.
Yeah.
Right. But you and I both taught classes. Mine was much more freeform. I was curious, you want to give a little, like, how'd your class go?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it went well. I told people, like, I had to get back to the booth afterwards. I talked for a second, but I was like, if you want to continue this conversation, totally open to it, come by the booth. And a good number of them did come by the booth after
that. That's awesome.
After, which I was happy about, and got to like kind of extend the conversation, answer more questions and stuff. And I really enjoyed it. A lot of faces I wasn't sure was going to show up, because I'm like,
right,
I've never taught a class, I've never even had a booth. Like, I don't know what kinds of people even attend these. Like, and almost everybody, I was like, I don't know them, which is a cool thing. There was a few people in there I'd met before, and some good friends, but a lot of people that I just had never met. And so it was great to meet them in that context and like have a conversation with them. And it was, I really,
what was the overall demographic? Is it Maker?
Man, it was a mix. Cause it was like Kyle Royer was in there.
Yeah.
Who's a ABS Master Smith, like pinnacle. I mean, he's just amazing. And then there's like a couple, at least one actual like manufacturer from, I can't remember they're from, but they were like four guys that own a machine shop that make components for knives. I don't know if they make complete knives.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then a couple other forge guys. It's a surprising number of forging guys in there.
That's I don't think it's surprising.
Okay.
You are presenting something that is outside of their immediate like wheelhouse in most cases. At a high level, you're presenting it to a group of professionals that like to learn things. And I think a lot of this is tied into the desire to have more productivity.
Mm.
Like, they're curious. Like, you're a CNC guy. They want to know.
Yeah. No, that's true. That someone that's less in line with me is more interested in it. Yeah.
In a certain way, right? Because it's like, oh, I do. Yeah, I'm curious about CNC, or like, I'm curious about like how I can do production.
Yeah.
I think that tracks. I love to hear that too, because it means that on, like, I always say like other side of the aisle, and this is like not an adversarial comment at all. It's that literally at knife shows, like a lot of times, like the stock removal guys are separated from like the forging guys. And it's like literally like a side of the aisle.
Yeah.
But I love seeing more crossover. Right. Same for me. Like, I want to learn more of that. I love seeing them want to be like, hey, how can I do a production model?
Well, it's just like you. I mean, you're one of your like pet projects has been learning about forging.
Yeah. And it's like, it's not, it's just to make me a better craftsperson.
Yeah.
Right. More well-rounded. Like purely for learning, for interest.
Yeah. One of the quick little story. One of the funny things that happened. So I have a booth that says Schwartz on it. I see this guy walking up and I know immediately that's Steve Schwartzer. And he's walking up from like, I can see him walking like beelining from all the way across. And he comes right up to me and he's like, somebody came over and told, asked me if I started a knife company. So I had to come check it out. And so it was the first time I ever met him. I don't know that he ever knew who I was before that, but we just he's had a great, good, we had man. A great conversation, but it was just funny that somebody was like, did you start a knife brand over there? Like Schwartz and Schwartzer. I love that.
He's a good dude.
Yeah. That was cool.
Our class was like super free form. It was basically on table sales and kind of like show etiquette. And it's not something. So I was basically just an assistant for Tom Crine. So he kind of had the outline for the class, but it's interesting because when you look at this, it's so hard to present even a baseline because the basics are basic, like basic show and table etiquette are really basic. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it just like spirals. We ended up hanging out for like an hour over the class time. Some people, I think, showed there was, I think, a mix of maker, non-maker. I could see where some people higher level, like things that started to push into like brand and strategy, people weren't interested. On the flip side, I saw the people that got super, super interested in that stuff. Mm-hmm. There was like basic, you know, just like it was a really diverse audience from a standpoint of like their own demand.
Yeah.
And your demand around your product drastically changes like what your table game is.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
You know, so like talking about like lotteries and like first come, first serves, like if you're talking about first come, first serve to someone who is not selling out a table, that's a different,
it's a little bit,
it's a little abstract.
Yeah. Cause it's like you're implying that you're willing to turn down a sale if you're doing these methods.
Lotteries. Which, basically. Like we got to break down a lot of that and like a little history of like show lotteries and stuff. It was, it was fun. Yeah. I really enjoy being included inside of like the Blade show. I don't know. Like, I don't even know what to consider that like expert, like roster.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an honor.
Feels good, right?
Yeah, it does. I was very, very happy that they invited me and that was cool.
I was bummed that I didn't get to see yours. Yours was Saturday. So
I didn't see yours either. So
I know.
We need to guess that's a, we talked about doing a podcast where it's like a two part, like you teach your class, I teach mine.
Well, that's a pretty, that's actually, that's a very good idea. Or at least discussing like the really meaty parts.
Fundamentals.
Of,
yeah.
Yeah. The fundamentals.
With mine, I had a bunch of note cards and each note card was like two words because I knew what I wanted to say, but I just was going to riff on each card.
Yeah.
And I practiced it like walking around in circles in the shop kind of like a few times and kind of was timing myself. I was like, yeah, that's a good amount of time. That's a good amount of time. I go in there and just like the extra adrenaline made me get through them way faster.
Yeah.
And I get through it and I look at the watch. I'm like, oh no. I'm like, ooh, that was a little early. So I pivoted and I started having questions come up. And I think the dots were connected the most in like the second half where they were asking questions. And I underestimated the value of that.
Yeah.
And so it was a little bit serendipitous that like me accelerating through it benefited us.
Worked out.
It felt like
I would say the same for us. Like the question that was really the only way to give actual advice.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's... I don't know what, are you in a booth? Are you in a table? Are you selling knives? Are you, what are you like? How many people are you bringing, 50 or three?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And as soon as they started asking questions, it started to like really flow. That's very, cause you're relating it to their experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you do a handout or anything like that?
I did not do a handout. I considered it. I gave them homework.
Nice.
But it was not in a handout. I kind of wrote on a whiteboard a little bit and I reiterated it enough times. I was hoping that people would do it and
How many can you like, can you verbally go through the homework or is it too much?
Yeah, I can.
What was
it? Yeah. So it was, there's two aspects, two angles to the same idea. One is that take a little bit of a moment to think back and in the current of what processes you have access to. So this could be something you can do or something that's close to you. Like you have a good friend who owns a machine shop. You have a friend who has a Cricut cutter. I mean, it could be anything, right? Like, and I'm not just talking about just anything. I'm talking about the ones that you have known to be exceptional. Cause it's like, I found that I've been in business long enough to have had experiences like with the person who prints the cards, my certificate of authenticity. One of my favorite people that I've ever worked with, and all he does is print my cards. But I'm like, he runs an exceptional business. He's right here in Boise. He's on the list. And I, like, think of the names and the processes that are the most identifiable as like, these are well-run operations with people at the head that are smart, with like end products that are good, and make a list of those exceptional things. And it, the longer you think, the more you can come up with. But if you can come up with that exceptional list and then look at the list and start thinking about what a product would be if you combine those already exceptional pieces, and start thinking about, rather than a product first and then how to make it, think of combining the exceptional things that you already know about into something that has value. You know what I mean? Because if you combine a bunch of exceptional people and exceptional businesses, processes, maybe something you're doing in-house that you have that's like what you excel at, if you can combine those, the product's going to kick ass, because it's like you've built it upside down. You've built from only like the gold bars. You know what I mean?
I mean, this is Pareto's law in production. Absolutely. So you're like 20% probably of like your vendors, you know, connections, other craft people.
Yep.
It's funny. I'm going to give a shout out to our screen printer right now for the absolute same reason. So we use this guy, Jordy, who is Days printing. And it's like, he's just so good and so talented. And it's like, even when I don't have something for him, like a lot of times I'll be like, man, what can I get Jordy on?
Yep.
Just because I like working with him so much. So it's like,
yeah,
that's a great exercise. Yeah. I love that. So I'll do that homework.
One of the big things is like, think about combining him with other people like that. You know what I mean? Like converging. Sometimes it's tricky. Sometimes it doesn't. You have to stare at that list for a long time.
You could also be a catalyst, right? It's like, you might get along with this person amazingly and they like you. You tie them into someone else and it doesn't work.
Yep. And then like the comb that I used to make, I've said multiple times, I used it as an example. That was what I did. I didn't have the like intentionality, but when I think back at my thought process, that's what I was doing. Was I was like, man, knives are so hard to make. What if I got all the people together that are good to work with and that isn't so difficult? What would it be? And it's like, I made a comb. It was so random.
But you're like, what was the process to make that comb? It was.
Yeah, that was the most complex thing I could think of. Complex, interesting, valuable thing I could make from a short list of vendors.
Yeah.
And the other facet is that if you already have a product and you need to create a list of the processes involved,
okay,
and look really hard at it and think about, like, you know, it's the old generic, like, a chain's only as strong as its weakest link.
Yeah.
But if there's a weak link in there, and we all almost intuitively know what the weak link is, you need to consider deleting or changing it, and not living with it, because you can't live with a bad piece of a process inside of your projects. You cannot live with it. Like, it is not okay to tolerate a weak link. And that sounds like kind of harsh. I'm not like, I don't know, maybe that came out weird, but I'm just saying it's only as good as its culmination of parts. And so you have to be really scrutinous over what you're doing. And it's easy to like live with something because that's just the way you're doing it.
Yeah.
But you intuitively know, you know where the weakness is in what you're doing.
Right.
And like I said, one of the angles is consider what would remain if that was just gone. And one of the famous quotes I've heard, it's actually from Elon Musk. He said, like, the best process is no process. And it's like, if you extracted that, and that's where like the LT5, our weakness in the Overland was Stonewash. Because Stonewash is the thing that slows us down the most.
Right.
And if I'm going to take Stonewash out and only have Cerakote, it creates friction because it's a stainless that's only going to be offered in Cerakote, which that's friction, right? That like becomes problematic. So the net decision is like carbon steel with Cerakote is a more sensical thing. So yeah. I'm like, if it was carbon steel, what people like carbon steel? Bushcraft people love carbon steel. I'm going to design a Bushcraft knife. So it started with the Overland. By pulling out Stonewash, it turned into a Bushcraft knife.
Yeah.
Because I just pulled on that thread. So it's like the process when something was missing was still a knife, but it needed a different target audience because I didn't want to just start selling only Cerakote stainless steels to the EDC world because they would complain. You know what I mean? Because it's for a good reason. It's like you have the most stainless steel in the world or one of them, and you only are offering it in Cerakote. Like, you know what I mean?
Tell you what, low key, that was basically a 2-minute masterclass in product development. Dude, I mean, that really, like, what you just went through surrounding the LT5, if people run their products through that thought process, the success rate goes up drastically. That's impressive. I don't think about my products that way.
And
that's super impressive.
It's backwards. Like I said, it's the process. Yeah. I mean, the process is the product. That's what I mean when I say that, is that you're selling that list. That's what I kept saying in the class. You're selling the list. And if the list has a bad thing in it, you're selling a dozen eggs with one that's rotten. So sell only good eggs. You know what I mean? And you can make a business that has weak links in the chain, but like to get like true acceleration out of your business and to, I think, reach like new levels and break barriers, you know, break the glass ceiling type situations, like you cannot afford the weakness.
And there's this tracks at different levels too, because as a, like, if you're a custom maker, a lot of times the weakest link is going to be a process that you have ownership of. And that there can be a decision there that, like, well, I like doing this. I like cutting everything on the bandsaw. I like hand grinding everything, but you will find a process that is the most time consuming, the least ergonomic, like the highest consumption, the highest risk of failure. There is something there, and you at least acknowledging it gives you tools to come up with solutions. It might be like for me, it would have been, I freehand ground everything for so long because of my design styles, right? I did these like curvy swoopy things early on. I couldn't figure out how to fixture it. When I started doing models that would have suited themselves to being fixtured, I didn't do it. That became my weakest link, right? Because now I'm doing a process in an inefficient way for a result that doesn't warrant it.
And one other thing I want to add is, like, I don't want it to always seem like you're trying to reduce this list, because that's not
right.
Like,
right.
It's not always reductionist, like simmer down. There's also, let's say you have your list for a product you're making. Let's say it's a SciPop or whatever.
Yeah.
Let's say you have something that is somewhat unique or hard to get, or you're good at that not a lot of people are good at. Like, it's kind of like a little gold star. Right. It's like you're really good at hand grinding or something.
Right. Right.
Try adding that to a list and see what it changes. Because, for example, in your case, if you add your freehand grinding skill to a knife,
right,
that allows you to do recurves and swoopy stuff.
Sure.
So if it's in that list, you should stretch the design to utilize it. You know what I mean? So what I'm saying is, like, when you add or reduce things in that list, let the design take the form that basically maximizes the list. You know what I mean?
What we do, like, almost, I'm just trying to think, like, this, this is a great, like, exercise for me to do. It's almost like the idea of a strength and weakness audit.
Yes.
Right. Or like, yeah. So like, letting efficient things be efficient has been like my goal. Right. So like that thought of the grinding would kind of fall into that category.
Yeah, it's
okay, I can't do this like compound recurve hollow grind on a fixture that my brain can come up with, but I can freehand grind it.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that as a production model, bad idea. Doing that as an open bid custom, good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Man, I haven't talked this much in a while.
Right.
I'm starting to lose my voice. Same. The flip side of that really is, are there processes that are unique, interesting, or like individual to you in some way,
yeah,
that you can apply to an efficient process and get a higher yield out of it at the end? So like finishing would be like a great example, exactly. Right? Like I can take a titanium part, I can do crazy anodizing to it that increases the value of that part.
And I made sure to iterate in the class, like it's also not about efficiency, because there's right, forge guys right. in there. There's Kyle Royer. So like, if you're really good at something that's really inefficient, which means it's really right. hard to replicate because it takes a lot of man hours and it's very hard to do, like hand grinding or like doing some crazy filigree
engraving or like handmade
Damascus or whatever. That doesn't mean, because that's inefficient, doesn't make it a weak link. It can actually be a strength, and the inefficiency creates value. So inefficiency can create value, like hand grinding. You know what I mean? If you're doing something that you can't do otherwise, but if you're hand grinding something inefficiently that is not gaining the product any feature that could be done efficiently, that's where you have a bad process for it. You know what I mean? It's like the inefficient thing needs to gain you something that efficient things do not.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's not.
And this is just like this, I think baseline, this is not being lazy around your process. Like just defaulting to like, well, this is how I make things. And it's like everything goes into that one category of making.
Yep.
You see this with people that are really, really skilled sometimes, and they make something super basic. But the basic thing is like almost too nice.
Mm-hmm.
Like for its form now. And you're like, yeah, you just defaulted to spending all of this time on finishes.
Yeah.
When in that product didn't require it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's pretty interesting. Okay. That's some good food for thought. So takeaway, if you're making things, maybe is to do that audit, do that homework. That's a really interesting exercise. I like it.
Glad you think so.
Yeah. I'm the weakest link. So that is over the years, like I know that in my processes, any process that I can remove myself from usually gets better.
Oh, geez. I don't think that's true.
I guess it depends on what the category is, but
yeah.
All right. Okay. So dude, I feel like that's a pretty good episode.
Hopefully that was a good rebound for you guys.
Good rebound. We're sorry guys that we've missed a slew of these, kind of back on track now, at least looking at our schedules. We will check in with Patreon. Saw some floating questions. Thanks for hanging out. Hopefully you're still here hanging out and listening.
Yeah. Thank you guys very much for your patience.
Yep. All right.
Peace.
Be well.